I'm Francesca Milliken-Slater, and welcome to Set 9 of Stories to Tell in the Middle of the Night. This is the last set of stories in this series. If you have enjoyed listening, give us a review or some stars, and if this is your first time, hello. You can hear other sets of stories and subscribe on iTunes, podcast, or the normal place you get your podcasts. In Stories to Tell in the Middle of the Night, I tell tales that aren't always about the night, but carry a sense of the night, of being awake when no one else is, unrest, when the sleep won't come. The things that keep us awake: frustrations, urges, losses, lovers, love, regrets, hope, perhaps. They are the stories I tell myself when I can't find my sleep. Today, tonight, we are looking towards hope. You've got to sometimes. My voice in your ear, sitting comfortably, cozy, on your speaker or by your bed at work, me and you, where we are. Let's say it's the cusp of morning. You are not sure if you've slept, if you were awake all night or not. You can't get the night back. You can't stop the light filtering in. Nautical dawn, so called because ships can still navigate by the layout of the stars just about out there in the middle of the sea. Day is coming. The sun is rising towards the horizon, 12 degrees to go, shining light on the frustrations and the urges and the loves and the lost as it leaves other places to the darkness on the other side of the horizon. The night lingering. Two stories and an ode to the morning, the dark needed to make sense for change, hope. In the first story, Fingertip. He'd grown up in a household of violence, in and out of the door late at night, in the afternoons when he arrived home. Alcohol-infused, sometimes, not always, as was thought. An easy language in casual slaps from backs of hands, a quieting jab in the ribs. Not that anything was quiet in the house that he lived. Packed into rooms and lofts and under stairs, you found your space where you could, heavy knocks at the door. But he buried himself in biology, the only thing he could get along with at school, the only thing he turned up to at school, the only class the teacher knew his name. Forensic posters stuck to half the wall he was allowed in the shared room with his brother, a good 5, 6 years older than him, in and out the door and stashes underneath the bed. Dissections were his favourite. While girls feigned squeamish eyes to attract their male counterparts in a performance they'd learned somewhere, those boys, those lads, found blood drawing from their face and bile swallowed in their mouth. But he dug right in. Fish, baby rats, on one occasion, picking in between their skeletons, weighing out their tiny organs, slicing into thin ankle bones. He always felt he had a finger too many, a digit too much, even though he was five-fingered on both hands in the traditional sense. Ideally, he'd have liked to have lost a limb. He knew the looks people gave him when he said this, from the side head-tipping concern to a sickening stare and a shutdown of conversation. He could never quite explain it to himself or want to mutilate his body, although he did not see it as mutilation, but modification, change. It was his body. He knew he could never lose a limb, not with the job he grew up to do. That concerned fitting and weights and lights, hanging things and working at height. Although, he had always quite fancied a hook for a hand. Not in a sinister way, could be useful, changeable attachments. He liked to feel discomfort, to know he was alive. He'd put himself in situations, the cold, the uncomfortable, money, when and where he could get it. We were not bred into comfort, he believed. We're wrapped in wool and commodity, any comfort, a click away, a delivery. He didn't believe in that. His culture had been in alcohol, though he never really liked the taste, but would drink because that's what drinkers do, until he didn't want to drink anymore. Felt the weight of it in his ankles and the flooding of his brain. He could carry on, always carry on, but it was time to stop. And once he made a decision, he stuck to what he said. So he picked the day he would last get pissed. No more booze after that. And he knew he would have to do it then. If not lose a limb, then get rid of the tip of a finger. He did not do this without thought. He picked the finger he used the least, the top of his left pinky. And he got shit-faced. Found himself in the middle of a bar fight, smile on his face as actual stools swung through the air. He never used the language of violence that he'd seen in place of words. He's been hit and kicked, but never hit back. He could feel it in him somewhere. The rage that rises up, he sees it, flat, angry eyes not knowing when to stop. So he never started on anyone. Home to more wine and what he could find until he knew the time was right. Corpus mentis as he was, calm as he could be, he took a knife, the big knife from the kitchen, and laid out his left hand. Just the tip, not too much, friend in the front room. I'll just be a moment. Holds the knife aloft and brings it down swiftly. Through the bone, blood everywhere along the surface tops. He wraps the little fingertip in a cloth and hides it deep in a bag of peas in his deep freeze and calls the hospital. He's looking for advice, really. Hadn't wanted to waste the time of an ambulance coming out. And they ask him how he did it. With a knife, he says. By accident? No, on purpose. An ambulance is sent as well as a police car, and they ask him where the tip of his finger is, but he won't tell them. Once he's back, he'll cut it open with a scalpel and a cake fork, look into the bones of his left little finger. They make him take a psychological test, a counsellor session for weeks. But he has not had a drink since 20 years or more, and never once regretted removing his fingertip. It is his own body only he has ever inflicted this single act of violence on. And from the onset of the internet, he joined forums in body modification, looked into cultures that did it themselves, got talking to a man that wanted to feature him in a book, and when he got the book, there it was, the story of the tip of his finger in amongst, well, a lot of cock and balls, sliced in two and weighted down, balls stretched and tied around. One man had cut his own leg off. And there he is, inadequate, just his little fingertip missing. He's still got the bone, though, and no longer deals up close to violence every day. Thank you to L for the generosity of his story. And with him in mind, we can look forward. The sun still rising into civil dawn, a twilight. Twilight translated in its origins of Middle English means two lights at once, in between night and day. Civil dawn is the sun rising. She's climbing 6 degrees before she hits the horizon, but the night is still there, lingering at the edges, swapping sides with the sun. But let's look towards the light, in the man who kept the world turning. It had been a superstition that he'd invented for himself just to get himself out of the pokey rented flat in the morning before work. He'd recently moved there for work, as people did these days, as people have always done, he guessed. Got to earn a living. New job wasn't much better. Aircon favoured over open windows, eyes down favoured over contact. Often he wasn't sure what he was actually doing, though it seemed to fill the hours that he worked. Screen time. So he told himself as a little joke to get himself out of bed in the morning to see the day before the day was work that, in order for the world to keep turning on its axis, he had to walk around the streets where he lived. Past a newsagent's and a small electrical shop, through a park with a singular bench, down a road that ran adjacent to his, past a boarded up pub and a cafe. It's a cafe, not a cafe. No more than 10, 15 minutes every day. It was his responsibility, and if he didn't do it, the world would not turn. Now, he knew in his heart of hearts this wasn't really true, but he needed a purpose to get things done, and he could think of no better purpose than to keep the world turning. The first time it happened, when the alarm went off at some blurry point, he almost stayed in bed. But then he remembered that the end of the world would be his responsibility if he didn't get up and walk around the streets where he lived. He didn't dwell too much on the logistics of who had been turning the world before him. It was barely breaking dawn. Foxes still slinking around eyed him in urban bravery. At least they looked him in the eye. And the people in that area, oh, they saw him walking around like that. They hadn't seen someone like him walking around like that. So they kept an eye on him, just to be careful. You know, you can't be too careful these days. And then they saw him do it the next day, and the next day, and the day after that. Even on the weekends, he was up, out walking at the same time. On the fourth day of his fourth week, he told himself that it was a stupid idea, that he'd probably be better off joining a gym, but somehow he'd convinced his rational thinking that the world really would stop turning if he didn't walk the streets. Out the flat door, past the newsagent who was collecting in the fresh morning papers, who gave him a nod and a smile. He nodded and smiled back. Carried on through the small park and saw two dog walkers talking animatedly to each other. They stopped when they saw him and gave him a wave. One of the dogs, he was sure, wagged his tail for him. Walking down the street that ran adjacent to his, he saw a woman coming out of her house, and he scuffed his shoes so she wouldn't think that he was lurking. She turned her head and said, "Morning." Past the boarded up pub where builders were standing in high-vis conversation with polystyrene cups. "Sorry, mate," they said as they stepped to one side to let him pass. He tried a "Mine's a milk with two sugars." They said, "Yeah? The calf's just round the corner. You can get us a round of bacon sandwiches if you want." Now the calf was open early doors, and although he had tea bags and coffee and milk at the flat, he went in through the steamed up windows and the ding-a-ling bell. "Hello, my friend. What can I get for you?" So now, every morning before work, come rain or shine, darkness or light, he makes the same journey round those streets. Now, the newsagent has given him a paper to give to the woman who lives on the road adjacent to his, Sally, who he sometimes cat-sits her cat for. He started to fill his pockets with treats for those dogs. They both really do wag their tail for him now. He once called the builder's bluff and bought them a round of bacon sarnies. Delighted as they were, they told him he'd better have put the right sauce in, and actually Trev was a veggie, so could he nip back and get an egg bap. He made the mistake of telling the people that ran the calf that he sort of thought he kept the world turning by walking around the streets every morning, and they called him Moonface in response, which he was pretty sure was down to a deep misunderstanding of the laws of physics and gravity, but he liked that he was known. Eyes down at work, but when walking round the streets, waving morning smiles, he thought, yeah, perhaps he sort of did keep this bit of the world turning. The builders finished turning the pub into flats. One of the dog walkers' dogs died, she didn't get out so much anymore, and he moved away. New job, new place. Sally had to get someone else to cat-sit her cat for her, and the world did not stop turning. But the people in the calf remember him fondly, old Moonface, and his walk to keep the world turning every morning. This is based on a man I would see every day, sometimes for hours, walking up and down the street that I lived on, until he didn't anymore. I moved house, city, circumstance, and found another man that would walk up and down that road that I then lived on, sometimes walking backwards while pulling a pram. The people that you see, the fantasies and suppositions based on thoughts of what might be happening or has happened. That's why we tell stories, or why I do, at night, to make sense of things I can't see or get back. Someone will die tonight, we know that. It's inherent to life, and tomorrow, this will all continue as it has done before, and it will do long after we're gone. Are we just trying to get some rest? Or trying to find some peace? The morning, as light breaks, the first cyclist on the road, you left your bed today. Today someone will look you in the eye, someone will listen to your words. That jogger in the dawn, head racing with your feet. Today someone will look you in the eye, someone will listen to your voice. That delivery driver, taking trucks down small lanes, driving all night within regulations. Today someone will look you in the eye, someone will hear your voice. We got through the night so far. There's always another one. Another way to treat it, in alcohol and dancing, in holding and feeding, in talking and coffee, in working in factories and sleeping during the day, but you own the night. We'll do it all again. We have the hope of morning breaking, light making, and you could close your eyes to sleep in the light, but be awake, just be awake just to see the day, because this night won't matter in years from now. Although, it will always matter to someone, as hearts stop, cut down, stolen, broken, bodies buried, thoughts misheard, unspoken or silenced. But we'll carry on trying to get some rest. We'll carry on trying to find our sleep. We'll carry on trying to open our eyes in the morning light and find some sort of peace, even if it's just in that moment of light, Even if it's raining, even if there's nothing else. What else are we trying to do but not die? On a day-to-day basis, what else are we trying to do but get through the night? There'll always be another night. There'll always be another day. The birds keep singing. You have been listening to the last set of stories from Series 1 of Stories to Tell in the Middle of the Night. If you would like another series of stories, and we would quite like to do one, perhaps with a different watery theme, let us know by rating, reviewing, tweeting, messaging us. You can visit storiestotellinthemiddleofthenight.com or tweet us at @MiddleNightTale. If you've not listened to all 9 sets of stories, you can download them at iTunes, Podcast, or where you usually get your podcasts. Stories to Tell started as a theatre show, born from ideas of people, friends, awake and up, in pain or anxiety, not being able to sleep. These stories are made to be listened to when you're awake, a light still on or not. It is written and voiced by me, Francesca Millican-Slater. You can find more of what I do at francescamillicanslater.co.uk. Sound design is by Ian Armstrong. Ian is Ian with 2 I's at ianarmstrong.net, with podcast support from Mark Stedman, who's stedman.io. Produced by Pippa Frith at pippafrith.co.uk, supported by Arts Council England. Copies of the original theatre text are published by Ink Concrete. You can buy or download at inkconcrete.com or on Amazon. We also have a selection of BSL video interpretations of these podcasts. These can be found at storiestotellinthemiddleofthenight.com. Stories to Tell in the Middle of the Night, the theatre show, was originally commissioned by Birmingham Repertory Theatre and was supported by Arts Council England, China Plate and the Sir Barry Jackson Trust. It was produced by Pippa Frith. Thanks for listening. Good night.